Los Angeles traffic proved challenging for someone as cautious as him. We sat at a stop sign waiting to turn right onto a busy road for like 10 minutes until three cars behind us were holding down their horns. Now that we're out of the city, though, he's doing great. Not even the lack of AC seems like a big deal with the windows down and sweetly flowery wind rushing over us. The bigger issue is the lack of an aux input, which has us relying on the radio.
Has there always been this much Billy Joel traveling over the airwaves?
Alex asks the third time we switch channels mid-commercial, only to plunge back into the middle of Piano Man. Since the dawn of time, I think. When the cavemen built the first radio, this was already playing.
I didn't know you were a historian, he deadpans. You should come talk to my class.
I snort. You could not drag me into the halls of East Linfield High with the combined force of every tractor in a 5-mile radius of that building, Alex.
You know, he says, your bullies have likely graduated by now.
We really can't be sure, I say. He looks over, face sober, mouth pressed small.
Do you want me to kick their asses?
I sigh. No, it's too late. Like, all of them have kids now with those cute oversized baby glasses, and most have found the Lord or started one of those weird pyramid scheme businesses selling lip gloss. He looks at me, his face pink from the sun.
If you change your mind, just say the word.
Alex knows about my rocky years in Linfield, of course, but for the most part, I try not to revisit them. I've always preferred the version of me that Alex brings out to the one I was back in our hometown. This Poppy feels safe in the world because he's in it too, and he, deep down where it matters, is like me. Still, he had an exceptionally different experience at West Linfield High than I had at its sister school. I'm sure it helped that he played sports, basketball, both for the school and in the intramural league at his family's church, and was handsome, but he's always insisted the clincher was that he was quiet enough to pass for mysterious rather than weird. Maybe if my parents hadn't been so completely encouraging of every facet of my brothers and my individualism, I would have had better luck. There were kids who dealt with disapproval by adapting, making themselves more palatable, like Prince and Parker had in school, finding the overlap between their personalities and everyone else's. And then there were people like me, who labored under the misconception that eventually my fellow children would not only tolerate, but ultimately respect me for being myself. There's nothing so off-putting to some people as someone who seems not to care whether anyone else approves of them. Maybe it's resentment. I have bent for the greater good to follow the rules, so why haven't you? You should care. Of course, secretly, I did care. A lot. Probably it would have been better if I'd just openly cried at school instead of shrugging off insults and weeping under my pillow later. It would have been better if, after the first time I was mocked for the flared overalls my mom had sewn embroidered patches onto, I hadn't kept wearing them with my chin held high, like I was some kind of 11-year-old Joan of Arc willing to die for my denim. The point was, Alex had known how to play the game, whereas I'd often felt like I'd read the pages of the guidebook backward, while the whole thing was on fire. When we were together, though, the game didn't even exist. The rest of the world dissolved until I believed this was how things truly were. Like I'd never been that girl who'd felt entirely alone, misunderstood, and I'd always been this one, known, loved, wholly accepted by Alex Nilsson. When we met, I hadn't wanted him to see me as Linfield Poppy. I wasn't sure how it would change the dynamic of our world for two once we let certain outside elements wriggle their way in. I still remember the night I finally told him about it. The last night of class our junior year, we'd stumbled back to his dorm from a party to find his roommate already gone for the summer. So I borrowed a t-shirt and some blankets from Alex and slept on the spare twin bed in his room. I hadn't had a sleepover like that since I was probably 8, the sort where you keep talking, eyes long since shut, until you both drift off mid-sentence. We told each other everything, the things we'd never touched,
Alex told me about his mom passing away, the months his dad barely changed out of pajamas, the peanut butter sandwiches Alex made for his brothers, and the baby formula he learned to mix. For 2 years, he and I'd had so much fun together, but that night, it felt like a whole new compartment in my heart opened, where before there had been none. And then he asked me what happened in Linfield, why I was dreading going back for the summer, and it should have felt embarrassing to air my small grievances after everything he'd just told me, except Alex had a way of never making me feel small or petty. It was so late, it was almost morning, those slippery hours when it feels safest to let your secrets out. So I told him all of it, starting with 7th grade. The unfortunate braces, the gum Kim Liddles put in my hair, and the resulting bowl cut. The insult added to injury when Kim told my whole class that anyone who talked to me wouldn't be invited to her birthday party, which was still a solid 5 months off, though it promised to be worth the wait, thanks to her pool's water slide and the movie theater in her basement. Then, in 9th grade, once the stigma had finally worn off and my boobs had arrived practically overnight, there was the 3-month stretch during which I was a hot commodity, until Jason Stanley kissed me unexpectedly and responded to my disinterest by telling everyone I gave him an unprompted blowjob in the janitor's closet. The entire soccer team called me Porny Poppy for like a year after that. No one wanted to be my friend. Then there was 10th grade, the worst of all. It started off better because the younger of my two brothers was a senior and willing to share his theater kid friend group with me, but that only lasted until I had a sleepover for my birthday, at which point I found out how embarrassing everyone thought my parents were. I quickly realized I didn't like my friends as much as I'd thought. I told Alex, too, about how much I loved my family, how protective I felt of them, but how even with them, I was sometimes a little lonely. Everyone else was someone else's top person. Mom and Dad, Parker and Prince, even the Huskies were paired up, while our terrier Mix and the cat spent most days curled together in a sun patch. Before Alex, my family was the only place I belonged, but even with them, I was something of a loose part, that baffling extra bolt IKEA packs with your bookcase just to make you sweat. Everything I'd done since high school had been to escape that feeling, that person. And I told him all of that, minus the part about feeling like I belonged with him, because even after 2 years of friendship, that seemed like a bit much. When I finished, I thought he'd finally fallen asleep. But after a few seconds, he shifted onto his side to gaze at me through the dark and said quietly, "I bet you were adorable with a bowl cut." I really, really wasn't, but somehow that was enough to cool the harsh sting of all those memories. He saw me, and he loved me. "Poppy," Alex says, bringing me back to the hot, stinky car and the desert. "Where are you right now?" I stick my hand out the window, grasping at the wind. "Wandering the halls of East Linfield High to a chant of Porny Poppy, Porny Poppy." "Fine," Alex says gently. "I won't make you visit my classroom to teach Billy Joel radio history. But just so you know," he looks at me, face serious, voice deadpan, "if any of my juniors called you Porny Poppy, I'd fucking waste them." "That has to be," I say, "the hottest thing anyone has ever said to me." He laughs, but looks away. "I'm serious. Bullying's the one thing I don't let them get away with." He tips his head in thought. "Except me. They bully me constantly." I laugh, even though I don't believe him. Alex teaches the AP and honors kids, and he's young, handsome, quietly hilarious, and freakishly smart. There's no way they don't adore him. "But do they call you Porny Alex?" I ask. He grimaces. "God, I hope not." "Sorry," I say, "Mr. Porny."
"Please, Mr. Porny is my father."
"I bet so many students have crushes on you."
"One girl told me I look like Ryan Gosling."
"Oh my God."
"If he got stung by a bee."
"Ouch,"
I say. I know. Alex agrees. Tough, but fair.
Maybe Ryan Gosling looks like you if he was left outside to dehydrate. Did you ever think of that?
Yeah. Take that, Jessica McIntosh, he says.
You bitch,
I say, then immediately shake my head.
Nope. Did not feel good to call a child a bitch. Bad joke.
Alex grimaces again. If it makes you feel any better, Jessica is not my favorite. But she'll grow out of a lot of it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, for all you know, she might be working against a lifetime of post-gum bowl cuts. It's nice of you to give her a chance.
You were never a Jessica, he says confidently.
I arch an eyebrow. How do you know?
Because. His eyes hold fast to the sun-bleached road. You've always been Poppy.
The Desert Rose apartment complex is a stucco building painted bubblegum pink, its name embossed in curling mid-century letters. A garden full of scrubby cacti and massive succulents winds around it, and through a white picket fence, we spot a sparkling teal pool, dotted with sun-browned bodies and ringed in palm trees and chaise longues. Alex turns the car off.
Looks nice, he says, sounding relieved.
I step out of the car, and the asphalt's hot, even through my sandals. I thought from summers in New York, trapped between skyscrapers with the sun pinballing back and forth ad infinitum, and all those earlier ones in the Ohio River Valley's natural humidity trap, that I knew what hot was. I did not. My skin tingles under the merciless desert sun, my feet burning just from standing still.
Shit,
Alex pants, sweeping his hair off his forehead. I guess this is why it's the off-season.
How did David and Tom live here?
He says, sounding disgusted. The same way you live in Ohio, I say, sadly and with heavy drinking. I mean it as a joke, but Alex's expression flattens out, and he heads to the back of the car without acknowledging what I said. I clear my throat. Kidding. Plus, they mostly live in LA, right? It was nowhere near this hot back there.
Here.
He passes me the first bag, and I take it, feeling chastened. Note to self, no more shitting on Ohio. By the time we get out our luggage and the two paper bags of groceries we grabbed during a CVS pit stop and wrestle it up three flights of stairs to our unit, we're sweat-drenched.
I feel like I'm melting,
Alex says as I punch the code into the key box beside the door.
I need a shower.
The box pops open, and I stick the key into the doorknob, jiggling and twisting it per the very specific instructions the host sent me. As soon as we go outside, we're going to be melting again, I point out. You might want to save the showering for right before bed. The key finally catches, and I bump the door open, shuffling inside, stopping short as two simultaneous warning bells start shrieking through my body. Alex walks into me, a solid wall of sweat-dampened heat.
What's...
His voice drops off. I'm not sure which horrible fact he's registering, that it's disgustingly hot in here, or that, in the middle of this otherwise perfect studio apartment, there sits one bed.
No,
he says quietly, as if he didn't mean to say it aloud. I'm sure he didn't. It said two beds. I blurt out, frantically trying to pull up the reservation. It definitely did. Because there's no way I could have possibly screwed up this badly. I couldn't have. There was a time when it might not have seemed like a huge deal for us to share a bed, but it is not this trip. Not when things are fragile and awkward. We have one chance to fix what broke between us.
You're sure?
Alex says. And I hate that note of annoyance in his voice even more than the suspicious one riding alongside it.
You saw pictures, with two beds.
I look up from my inbox. Of course. But did I? This unit had been ridiculously cheap, in large part because a reservation had canceled last minute. I knew it was a studio, but I saw pictures of the sparkly turquoise pool and the happy dancing palm trees, and the reviews said it was clean, and the kitchenette looked small but chic, and did I actually see two beds? This guy owns a bunch of apartments here,
I say, head swimming. He probably sent us the wrong unit number. I find the right email and click through the pictures. Here, I cry. Look! Alex steps in close, looking over my shoulder at the pictures. A bright white and gray apartment with a couple of thriving, potted, fiddle-leaf figs in one corner and a vast white bed in the middle of the room, a slightly smaller one beside it. Okay, so there might have been some artful angling to these photographs, because in the shot, the bigger bed looks like it's king-sized when it's actually a queen, which means the other couldn't be bigger than a double, but it definitely should exist.
I don't understand.
Alex looks from the photo to where the second bed should be.
Oh,
he and I say in unison as it clicks. He crosses to the wide, armless chair in coral imitation suede and yanks off the decorative pillows, reaching into the seam of the chair. He folds the bottom out, the back pressing down so that the whole thing flattens into a long, skinny pad with sagging seams between its three sections.
A pull-out chair.
I'll take that, I volunteer. Alex shoots me a look.
You can't, Poppy.
Why, because I'm a woman and they'll take your Midwestern masculinity away if you don't fall on the sword of every gender norm presented to you?
No, he says, because if you sleep on that, you'll wake up with a migraine.
That happened once, I say, and we don't know it was from sleeping on the air mattress. It could have been the red wine. But even as I say it, I'm searching for the thermostat, because if anything's going to make my head throb, it's sleeping in this heat. I find the controls inside the kitchenette. Oh my gosh, he has it set to 80 degrees in here.
Seriously?
Alex scrubs a hand through his hair, catching the sweat beading on his forehead.
And to think it doesn't feel a degree over 200.
I crank the thermostat down to 70, and the fan kicks on loudly, but without any instant relief. At least we have a view of the pool, I say, crossing to the back doors. I throw the blackout curtains back and balk, the remnants of my optimism fizzling out. The balcony is way bigger than mine at home, with a cute red cafe table and two matching chairs. The problem is, three quarters of it is walled off with plastic sheeting, as, somewhere overhead, a horrible melee of mechanical rattles and screeches sound off. Alex steps out beside me.
Construction?
I feel like I'm inside a Ziploc bag inside of someone's body.
Someone with a fever, he says.
Who's also on fire? He laughs a little, a miserable sound he tries to play off as lighthearted. But Alex isn't lighthearted. He's Alex. He's high stress, and he likes to be clean and have his space, and he packs his own pillow in his luggage because his neck is used to this one, even though it means he can't bring as many clothes as he'd like. And the last thing this trip needs is any unnecessary pushing on our pressure points. Suddenly, the 6 days ahead of us seem impossibly long. We should have taken a 3-day trip, just the length of the wedding festivities, when there'd be buffers galore and free booze and time blocked out that Alex would be busy with his brother's bachelor party and whatever else. Should we go down to the pool? I say, a little too loud, because by now my heart is racing and I have to yell to hear myself over it.
Sure,
Alex says, then turns back to the door and freezes. His mouth hangs open as he considers his words.
I'll change in the bathroom, and you can just shout when you're finished.
Right. It's a studio. One open room with no doors except the one to the bathroom. Which wouldn't have been awkward if we weren't both being so freaking awkward.
Mm-hmm,
I say.
Sure.
10 summers ago. We wander the city of Victoria until our feet hurt, our backs ache, and all that sleep we didn't get on the flights makes our bodies feel heavy and our brains light and floaty. Then we stop for dumplings in a tiny nook of a place whose windows are tinted and whose red-painted walls are elaborately looped in gold mountainscapes and forests and flowing rivers that serpentine through low, rounded hills. We're the only people inside. It's 3 p.m., not quite late enough for dinner, but the air conditioning is powerful and the food is divine, and we're so exhausted we can't stop laughing about every little thing. The hoarse, voice-cracking yelp Alex let out when the plane touched down this morning. The suit-wearing man who sprints past the restaurant at top speed, his arms held flat to his sides. The gallery girl in the Empress Hotel who spent 30 minutes trying to sell us a 6-inch, $21,000 bear sculpture while we dragged our tattered luggage around behind us.
"We don't really have money for that," Alex said, sounding diplomatic.
The girl nodded enthusiastically.
"Hardly anyone does, but when art speaks to you, you find a way to make it work."
Somehow, neither of us could bring ourselves to tell the girl that the $21,000 bear was not speaking to us, but we'd spent all day since then picking things up, a signed Backstreet Boys album in the used record shop, a copy of a novel called What My G-Spot Is Telling You in a squat little bookstore off a cobbled street, a pleather catsuit in a fetish shop I led Alex into, primarily to embarrass him, and asking, "Does this speak to you?"
"Yes, Bobby, it's saying bye, bye, bye."
"No, Alex, tell your G-spot to speak up."
"Yes, I'll take it for $21,000 and not a penny less."
We took turns asking and answering, and now, slumped over our black lacquered table, we can't stop half deliriously picking up spoons and napkins, making them talk to one another. Our server is around our age, heavily pierced with a soft lisp and a good sense of humor.
"If that soy says anything saucy, let me know," she says. "It's got a reputation around here."
Alex tips her 30%, and the whole walk to the bus stop, I tease him for blushing whenever she looked at him, and he teases me for making eyes at the cashier in the record shop, which is fair, because I definitely did.
"I've never seen a city this flowery," I say.
"I've never seen a city this clean," he says.
"Should we move to Canada?" I ask.
"I don't know," he says. "Does Canada speak to you?"
With the buses and the walking between stops, it takes 2 hours total to get the car I informally rented online through WWT, Women Who Travel. I'm so relieved it actually exists, and that the keys are under the floor mat in the back seat, just like the car's owner Esmeralda said they would be, that I start clapping at the sight of it.
"Wow," Alex says, "this car is really speaking to you."
"Yes," I say. "It's saying, don't let Alex drive."
His mouth droops open, eyes going wide and glossy with feigned hurt.
"Stop!"
I yelp, diving away from him and into the driver's seat like he's a live grenade.
"Stop what?"
He bends to insert his sad puppy face in front of me.
"No!"
I screech, shoving him away and writhing sideways in the seat as if trying to escape a swarm of ants pouring off him. I fling myself into the passenger seat, and he calmly climbs into the driver's seat.
"I hate that face," I say.
"Untrue," Alex says.
He's right. I love that ridiculous face. Also, I hate driving.
"When you find out about reverse psychology, I'm screwed," I say.
"Hmm?"
he says, glancing sidelong as he starts up the car.
"Nothing."
We drive 2 hours north to the motel I found on the eastern side of the island. It's a misty wonderland, wide, uncluttered roads lined in forests as ancient as they are dense. There's not a ton to do in town, but there are redwoods and hiking trails to waterfalls and a Tim Hortons just a few miles down the road from our motel, a low, lodge-like place with a gravel parking lot out front and a wall of fog-cloaked foliage behind it.
"I sort of love it here," Alex says.
"I sort of do too," I agree.
And it doesn't matter that it rains all week and we finish every hike soaked to the bone, or that we can only find 2 affordable restaurants and have to eat at each of them thrice, or that we slowly start to realize nearly everyone else we cross paths with is in the upper 60s and older set, and that we're definitely staying in a retirement village, or that our motel room is always damp, or that there's so little to do, we have time to kill 1 full day in a nearby Chapters bookstore,
where we eat both breakfast and lunch in their cafe in silence while Alex reads Murakami and I take notes for future reference from a stack of Lonely Planet guides. None of it matters. I spend the whole week thinking, this speaks to me. This is what I want for the rest of my life. To see new places, to meet new people, to try new things. I don't feel lost or out of place here. There's no Linfield to escape or long, boring classes to dread going back to. I'm anchored only in this moment. Don't you wish we could always be doing this? I ask Alex. He looks up over his book at me, one corner of his mouth curling.
Wouldn't leave a lot of time for reading.
What if I promise to take you to a bookstore in every city? I ask. Then will you quit school and live in a van with me? His head tilts to one side as he thinks.
Probably not, he says,
which is no surprise for a variety of reasons, including the fact that Alex loves his classes so much he's already researching English grad programs, whereas I'm muscling through with straight C's. Well, I had to try, I say with a sigh. Alex sets his book down.
I'll tell you what, you can have my summer breaks. I'll keep those wide open for you, and we'll go anywhere you want that we can afford.
Really? I say, dubious.
Promise.
He holds out his hand, and we shake on it, then sit there grinning for a few seconds, feeling like we've just signed some life-alteringly significant contract. Our second-to-last day, we hike through the quiet of Cathedral Grove just as the sun is coming up, spilling golden light over the forest in little droplets. And when we leave, we drive straight to a town called Coombs, whose main attraction is a handful of cottages with grass roofs and a herd of goats grazing over them. We take pictures of them, stick our heads through photo-op cutouts that put our faces on crudely painted goat bodies, and spend a luxurious 2 hours wandering a market stuffed with samples of cookies, candies, and jams. On the last full day of our trip, we drive across the island to Tofino, the peninsula we would have stayed on if we weren't trying to save every possible penny. I surprise Alex with, perhaps worryingly cheap, tickets for a water taxi that takes us to the island I read about, with the trail through the rainforest to the hot spring. Our water taxi driver is named Buck, and he's not much older than us, with a tangle of sun-bleached yellow hair sticking out from under his mesh-backed hat. He's handsome in an utterly filthy way, with that specifically beachy kind of body odor mixed with patchouli. It should be repulsive, but he makes it work. The ride itself is a violent affair, the taxi's motors so loud I have to scream into Alex's ear, my hair slapping against his face from the wind, to say, "This must be what a rock feels like when you skip it over water!" My voice thunking in and out with each rhythmic hit of the little vessel against the top of the dark, choppy waves. Buck waves his hands like he's talking to us for the whole length of the much-too-long ride, but we can't hear him, which makes both Alex and me semi-hysterical with laughter after the first 20 minutes of inaudible monologue.
"What if he's confessing to a crime right now?" Alex yells.
"Reciting the dictionary from back to front," I suggest.
"Solving complex math equations," Alex says.
"Communing with the dead," I say.
"This is worse than..."
Buck cuts the engine, and Alex's voice far overshoots it. He drops his voice into a whisper against my ear.
"Worse than flying."
"Is he stopping to kill us?"
I whisper back.
"Was that what he was saying?"
Alex hisses.
"Is it time to panic?"
"Look out that way,"
Buck says, spinning leftward in his chair and pointing ahead.
"Where he's going to kill us?"
Alex murmurs, and I turn my laugh into a cough. Buck turns back with a wide, crooked, but admittedly handsome grin.
"Family of otters."
A very high-pitched and 100% genuine squeal rockets out of me as I lurch to my feet and lean over to see the fuzzy little lumps of fur floating over the waves, paws folded together so that they drift as one, a net made of adorable sea creatures.
Alex comes to stand behind me, his hands light on my arms as he leans over me to see.
Okay, he says. Time to panic. That's fucking adorable.
Can we take one home? I ask him. They speak to me.
After that, the hike through the lush ferns of the rainforest and the hot, earthy waters of the spring, though amazing, can't quite compare to that spine-compressing water taxi ride. When we strip down to our bathing suits and slip into the warm, cloudy pool within the rocks, Alex says,
"We saw otters holding hands."
"The universe likes us," I say. "This has been a perfect day,
a perfect trip."
"It's not over yet," I say. "One more night."
When Buck's water taxi delivers us safely into harbor that night, we huddle into the little time-warped shack the company uses as an office to pay.
"Where are you guys staying?"
Buck asks as he takes the coupons I printed out and manually punches their code into a computer.
"Other side of the island," Alex says, "outside in a Noose Bay."
Buck's blue eyes come up, cut between Alex and me appraisingly.
"My grandparents live in Nanoose Bay."
"It kind of seems like every grandparent in British Columbia might live in Nanoose Bay," I say, and Buck lets out a bark of laughter.
"What are you doing there?" he asks. "Not a great spot for a young couple." "Oh, we're not."
Alex shifts uncomfortably from one foot to the other.
"We're like non-biological, non-legal siblings," I say.
"Just friends,"
Alex translates, seeming embarrassed for me, which is understandable because I can feel my cheeks go lobster red and my stomach flip when Buck's eyes settle on me. They shift back to Alex, and he smiles.
"If you don't want to drive back to the old folks' home tonight, my housemates and I have got a yard and a spare tent. You're welcome to crash there. We've always got people staying with us."
I'm fairly sure Alex does not want to sleep on the ground, but he takes one look at me and must see how into this idea I am. This is exactly the kind of spur-of-the-moment, out-of-nowhere surprise turn I've been hoping this trip would take, because he lets out an almost imperceptible sigh, then turns back to Buck with a fixed smile.
"Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks." "Cool. You all were my last trip, so let me close up and we can head out."
As we're walking back down the dock afterward, Alex asks for the address so we can plug it into the GPS.
"Nah, man," Buck says. "You don't need to drive."
It turns out Buck's house is just up a short, steep driveway a half block from the dock, a droopy, graying, two-story house with a second-floor balcony covered in drying towels and bathing suits and shitty folding furniture. There's a bonfire burning in the front yard, and even though it's only 6 p.m., there are dozens of grungy Buck types gathered in sandals and hiking boots or dirt-crusted bare feet, drinking beer and doing acro yoga in the grass while trance music plays over a pair of duct tape-ridden speakers on the porch. The whole place smells like weed, like this is some kind of low-rent, miniature Burning Man.
"Everyone?" Buck calls as he leads us up the hillside. "This is Poppy and Alex. They're from..."
He looks over his shoulder at me, waiting.
"Chicago,"
I say, as Alex says,
"Ohio." "Ohio and Chicago," Buck repeats.
People call out greetings and tip their beers, and a lean, muscly girl in a woven crop top brings me and Alex each a bottle. And Alex tries very hard not to look at her stomach as Buck disappears into the circle of people around the fire, doing that back-slapping hug with a handful of people.
"Welcome to Tofino," she says. "I'm Daisy." "Another flower," I say. "But at least they don't use yours to make opium."
"I haven't tried opium," Daisy says thoughtfully. "I pretty much stick to LSD and shrooms. Well, and weed, obviously."
"Have you tried those sleep gummies?" I ask. "Those things are fucking amazing."
Alex coughs.
"Thanks for the beer, Daisy."
She winks.
"My pleasure. I'm the welcome committee. And the tour guide."
"Oh, do you live here too?" I ask.
"Sometimes," she says.
"Who else does?"
Alex says.
"Hmm.
Daisy turns, scouring the crowd and vaguely pointing.
Michael, Chip, Tara, Kabir, Lou.
She gathers her dark hair off her back and pulls it to one side of her neck as she continues.
Mo, Quincy sometimes. Lita's been here for a month, but I think she's leaving soon. She got a job as a rafting guide in Colorado. How far is Chicago from there? You should look her up if you're ever visiting.
Cool, Alex says. Maybe so.
Buck reappears between me and Alex, with a joint tucked in his mouth, and slings a casual arm around each of us.
Has Daisy given you the tour yet?
Was just about to, she says.
But somehow, I don't wind up on a tour of this soggy house. I wind up sitting in a cracked plastic Adirondack chair by the fire with Buck and, I think, Chip and Lita, the soon-to-be rafting guide, ranking Nicolas Cage movies by various criteria as the deep blues and purples of twilight melt into the deeper blues and blacks of night, the starry sky seeming to unfurl over us like a great, light-pricked blanket. Lita is an easy laugher, which I've always thought was a criminally underappreciated trait, and Buck is so laid back, I start to get a secondhand high just from sharing a chair with him. And then I get my first-hand high when I share his joint with him.
Don't you love it?
He asks eagerly when I'm a few puffs in. Love it, I say. Truthfully, I think it's just okay. And moreover, if I were anywhere else, I think I might even hate it. But tonight, it's perfect, because today is perfect. This trip is perfect. Alex checks back in on me after his tour, by which point, yes, I'm sitting curled up in Buck's lap with his sweatshirt draped around my chilly shoulders. You okay? Alex mouths from the far side of the fire. I nod. You? He nods back, and then Daisy asks him something, and he turns away, falling into conversation with her. I tip my head back and stare up past Buck's unshaven jawline to the stars high above us. I think I could stand it if this night lasted 3 more days, but eventually the sky is changing color again, the morning mist hissing off the damp grass as the sun peeks over a horizon somewhere in the distance. Most of the crowd has drifted off, Alex included, and the fire has burned down to embers when Buck asks me if I want to come inside, and I tell him, yes, I do. I almost tell him that going inside speaks to me, then remember that's not a worldwide joke, it's just one of mine and Alex's, and I don't really want to say it to Buck after all. I'm relieved to discover that he has a room of his own, even if it is closet-sized, with a mattress on the floor dressed in nothing but 2 unzipped sleeping bags rather than bedding. When he kisses me, it's rough and scratchy and tastes like weed and beer, but I've only kissed 2 people before this, and one of those was Jason Stanley, so this is still going great in my book. His hands are confident, if a little lazy, to match the rest of him, and soon we're climbing onto the mattress, hands catching in each other's seawater-tangled hair, hips locking together. He has a nice body, I think, the kind that's mostly taut from an active lifestyle, with a little pudge from indulging in his various vices. Not like Alex's, which has been made in the gym over years with discipline and care. Not that Alex's body isn't great. It is great. And not that there's any reason to compare the two, or any 2 bodies, really. It's sort of messed up that the thought even popped into my head. But it's just because Alex's is the man body I'm most used to being around, and it's also the kind I expect I won't ever touch. People like Alex, careful, conscientious, gym-fit, reserved people, tend to go for people like Sarah Torval, Alex's careful, conscientious, yoga bunny crush from the library. Whereas people like me are more likely to wind up making out with people like Buck on their floor mattresses on top of their unzipped sleeping bags. He's all tongue and hands, but even so, it's fun to kiss this near stranger, to have fervent, appreciative permission to touch him. It's like practice. Perfect, fun practice with some guy I met on vacation, who holds no bearing on my real life, who only knows Poppy right now, and doesn't need any more than that. We kiss until my lips feel bruised and our shirts have come off, and then I sit up in the dawn dark, catching my breath. I don't want to have sex, okay?
Oh, right on, he says lightly, sitting up against the wall. That's cool. No pressure.
And he doesn't seem to feel any hint of awkwardness about this, but he also doesn't pull me back to him, kiss me again. He just sits there for a minute, like he's waiting for something. What? I say.
Oh.
He glances toward the door, then back to me.
I just thought, if you don't want to hook up.
And then I understand. You want me to leave?
Well,
he gives a sheepish, or sheepish for him anyway, half laugh that still sounds kind of barky.
I mean, if we're not going to have sex, then I might.
He trails off, and now my own laugh catches me by surprise. Are you going to hook up with someone else? He seems genuinely concerned when he says,
does that make you feel bad?
I stare back at him for 3 full seconds.
Look, if you wanted to have sex, you'd be like, I'd want to. Like, I definitely do. But since you don't, are you mad?
I burst out laughing. No, I say, pulling my shirt back on. I'm actually really, really not mad. I appreciate the honesty. And I mean it, because this is just Buck, some guy I met on vacation, and all things considered, he has been something of a gentleman.
Okay, cool,
he says, and flashes that laid-back grin of his, which almost glows in the dark.
I'm glad we're cool.
We're cool, I agree. But you said something about a tent?
Oh, right.
He slaps his hand to his forehead.
The red and black one out front's all you, girl.
Thanks, Buck, I say, and stand. For everything.
Hey, hold on a second.
He leans over and grabs a magazine off the floor beside his mattress, digs around for a marker, then scribbles something on the white edge of a page and tears it out.
If you're ever back on the island, he says, don't stay in my grandparents' neighborhood, okay? Just come stay here. We've always got room.
With that, I slip out of the house, past rooms that are already, or still, playing music, and doors through which soft sighs and moans emanate. Outside, I pick my way down the dewy porch steps and head to the red and black tent. I'm fairly sure I saw Alex disappear inside the house with Daisy hours ago, but when I unzip the tent, he's fast asleep in it. I carefully crawl inside, and when I lie down beside him, he just barely opens his puffy with sleep eyes and rasps,
Hey.
Hey, I say. Sorry to wake you.
It's okay,
he says.
How was your night?
Okay, I tell him. I made out with Buck. His eyes widen for a second before shrinking back to sleepy slivers of hazel.
Wow,
he croaks, then tries to swallow down a spark of sleepy laughter.
Did the curtains match the very troubling drapes?
Laughing, I give his leg a shove with my foot. I didn't tell you so you could mock me.
Did he tell you what he was saying that whole time on the water taxi?
Alex asks through another rattle of laughter.
How many people were in the hammock with you?
I start to laugh so hard there are tears leaking from the corners of my eyes.
He kicked.
It's hard to get words out between wheezes of laughter, but eventually I manage.
Kicked me out when I told him I didn't want to have sex. Oh my God,
Alex says, sitting up on his elbow, the sleeping bag falling down from his bare chest and his hair dancing with static.
What a dick.
No, I say. It was fine. He just wanted to get some, and if not from me, there are easily 400 more girls on this half acre of sinking woods. Alex flops back down on his pillow.
Yeah, well, I still think that's kind of shitty.
Speaking of girls, I say, smirking.
We weren't,
Alex says. Did you hook up with Daisy? He rolls his eyes.
Do you think I hooked up with Daisy?
Until you said it like that, yes. Alex adjusts his arm under his pillow.
Daisy isn't my type.
True, I say. She's nothing like Sarah Torval. Alex rolls his eyes again, then closes them entirely.
Go to sleep, weirdo.
Through a yawn, I say, sleep speaks to me. 11. This summer. There are plenty of empty chaise longues available at the Desert Rose Complex pool. Everyone's in the water, so Alex and I take our towels over to two in the corner. He winces as he lowers himself to sitting.
The plastic's hot.
Everything's hot. I plop down beside him and peel off my cover-up. What percentage of that pool do you think is pee by now? I ask, tipping my head to the gaggle of sun hat-wearing babies splashing on the steps with their parents. Alex grimaces.
Don't say that.
Why not?
Because it's so hot, I'm going to get in the water anyway, and I don't want to think about it.
He glances away as he draws his white t-shirt over his head, then folds it and twists to set it on the ground behind him, the muscles pulling taut along his chest and stomach in the process. How have you gotten more ripped? I ask.
I haven't.
He pulls the sunblock from my beach bag and pumps some into his hand. I look down at my own stomach, hanging over the tight, highlighter orange of my bikini bottoms. In the last few years, my lifestyle of airplane cocktails and late-night burritos, gyros, and noodles has started to fill me out and soften me. Fine, I say to Alex. Then you look exactly the same while the rest of us are starting to droop in the eyes and the boobs and the neck and get more and more stretch marks and pock marks and scars.
Do you really want to look like your 18-year-old self?
He asks and starts to smear big globs of sunblock onto his arms and chest. Yes. I pick up the bottle of Banana Boat and work some of it onto my shoulders. But I'd settle for 25. Alex shakes his head, then bows it as he slathers more sunblock onto his neck.
You look better than you did back then, Poppy.
Really? Because the comment section on my Instagram would disagree, I say.
That's all bullshit, he says. Half the people on Instagram have never lived in a world where every picture wasn't edited. If they saw you in real life, they'd pass out. My students are all obsessed with this Instagram model who's completely CGI. This animated girl literally looks like a video game character, and every time the account posts, they all freak out about how beautiful she is.
Oh yeah, I know that girl, I say. I mean, I don't know her, she's not real, but I know the account. Sometimes I go down deep rabbit holes reading the comments. She has a rivalry with another CGI model. Do you want me to get your back?
What?
He looks up, confused. I lift the bottle of sunblock up. Your back? It's facing the sun right now.
Oh, yeah, thanks.
He turns around and ducks his head, but he's still tall enough that I have to sit up on my knees to get the spot between his shoulder blades.
Anyway, he clears his throat. The kids know I get seriously repulsed by the uncanny valley, so they always try to trick me into looking at pictures of that fake girl just to watch me writhe. It kind of makes me feel bad for doing that sad puppy face at you all these years.
My hands go still on his warm, sun-freckled shoulders, my stomach pinching. I'd be sad if you stopped doing that. He looks over his shoulder at me, his profile cast in cool blue shadow as the sun beats down on him from the other side. For a millisecond, I feel fluttery from his closeness, from the feeling of his shoulder muscles under my hands, and the way his cologne mixes with the coconut sweetness of the sunblock, and the way his hazel eyes fix on me firmly. It's a millisecond that belongs to that other 5%, the what if. If I leaned forward and kissed him over his shoulder, slipped his bottom lip between my teeth, twisted my hands into his hair until he turned himself around and pulled me into his chest. But there's no more room for that what if, and I know that. I think he knows it too, because he clears his throat and glances away.
Want me to get your back too?
Mm-hmm. I manage, and we both turn again so that now he's facing my back, and the whole time his hands are on me, I'm actively trying not to register it.
trying not to feel something hotter than the Palm Springs sun gathering behind my belly button as his palms gently scrape over me. It doesn't matter that there are babies squealing and people laughing and preteens cannonballing into far too small spaces in the pool. There's not enough stimuli in this busy pool to distract me, so I move on to a hastily formed plan B.
"Do you ever talk to Sarah?"
I blurt out, my voice a full octave higher than usual. Alex's hands lift off me.
"Sometimes. You're done, by the way."
"Cool. Thanks."
I turn around and shift back onto my chaise, putting a good foot of space between us.
"Is she still teaching at East Linfield?"
With how competitive teaching jobs were these days, it seemed like a dream when they both found positions at the same school and moved back to Ohio. Then they broke up.
"Yep."
He reaches into my bag and pulls out the water bottles we filled with the pre-made margarita slushies we got at CVS. He hands me one of them.
"She's still there."
"So you must see each other a lot," I say. "Is that awkward?"
"No, not really,"
he offers. "You don't really see each other a lot, or it's not really awkward?" He buys some time with a long chug on the water bottle.
I guess either.
"Is she seeing anyone?" I ask.
"Why?"
Alex says.
"I didn't think you even liked her."
"Yeah,"
I say, embarrassment coursing through my veins like a quick-hitting drug.
"But you did, so I want to make sure you're okay."
"I'm okay,"
he says, but he sounds uncomfortable, so I drop it. No shitting on Ohio, no talking about Alex's ridiculously fit body, no looking him deep in the eyes from fewer than 6 inches away, and no bringing up Sarah Torval. I can do that. Probably.
"Should we get in the water?" I ask.
"Sure."
But as we pick our way through the herd of babies to move down the whitewashed pool steps, it rapidly becomes clear that this isn't the solution to the touch-and-go awkwardness between us. For one thing, the water, with all the many bodies standing and potentially peeing in it, feels nearly as hot as the air, and somehow even more unpleasant. For another thing, it's so crowded that we have to stand so close that the upper two-thirds of our bodies are almost touching. When a stocky man in a camo hat pushes past me, I collide with Alex, and a lightning bolt of panic sizzles through me at the feeling of his slick stomach against mine. He catches me by the hips, at once steadying me and easing me away, back to my rightful place 2 inches away from him.
"You okay?"
he asks.
"Mm-hmm,"
I say, because all I can really focus on is the way his hands spread over my hip bones. I expect there to be a lot of that on this trip. The mm-hmming, not the gigantic Alex hands on my hips. He lets go of me and cranes his neck over his shoulder, looking back to our lounges.
"Maybe we should just read until it's less crowded,"
he suggests.
"Good idea."
I follow him in a zigzagging path back to the pool steps, to the burning hot cement, to the two short towels we spread on the chaises, where we lie down to wait. He pulls out a Sarah Waters novel, which he finishes, then follows with an Augustus Everett book. I take out the latest issue of R&R, planning to skim everything I didn't write. Maybe I'll find a spark of inspiration I can take back to Swapna so she won't be mad at me. I pretend to read for 2 sweaty hours, and the pool never empties out. As soon as we open the door to the apartment, I know things are going to get worse.
"What the hell?"
Alex says, following me inside.
"Did it get hotter?"
I hurry to the thermostat and read the numbers illuminated there.
82?
"Maybe we're pushing it too hard,"
Alex suggests, coming to stand beside me.
"Let's see if we can get it back down to 80 at least."
"I know 80 is technically speaking better than 82, Alex," I say. "But we're still going to murder each other if we have to sleep in 80-degree heat."
"Should we call someone?"
Alex asks.
"Yes, we should definitely call someone. Good thinking."
I rifle through the beach bag for my phone and search my email for the host's phone number. I hit call, and it rings 3 times before a gruff, smoky voice comes over the line.
Yeah?
Nikolai? 2 seconds of silence.
Who is this?
This is Poppy Wright. I'm staying in 4B.
Okay.
We're having some trouble with the thermostat. 3 seconds of silence this time.
Did you try Googling it?
I ignore the question and forge ahead. It was set to 80 degrees when we got here. We tried to turn it down to 72 hours ago, and now it's 82.
Oh, yeah,
Nikolai says.
You're pushing it too hard.
I guess Alex can hear what Nikolai's saying because he nods, like, told you. So it can't handle going colder than 78? I say. Because that wasn't in the posting, and neither was the construction outside the...
It can only do a degree at a time, honey,
Nikolai says with a beleaguered sigh.
You can't just push a thermostat down to 70 degrees, and who keeps an apartment 70 degrees anyway?
Alex and I exchange a look.
67,
he whispers. 65, I mouth, gesturing to myself. Well,
look, honey.
Nikolai cuts me off again.
Turn it down to 81. When it gets down to 81, turn it down to 80. Then turn it down to 79. And when it gets down to 79, you set it to 78. And once it's 78,
go ahead and just cut off your own head, Alex whispers, and I pull the phone away from me before Nikolai can hear me laugh. I drag it back to my cheek, and Nikolai's still explaining how to count backward from 82. Got it, I say. Thanks.
No prob,
Nikolai says with another sigh.
Have a good stay, honey.
As I hang up, Alex crosses back to the thermostat and turns it back up to 81.
Here goes literally nothing.
If we can't get it to work, I trail off as the full force of our situation hits me. I was going to say that if we couldn't get it to work, I'd just book us a hotel room with the R&R card. But of course, we can't. I could put it on my own credit card, but living in New York in a too-nice-for-me apartment, I don't actually have a ton of expendable income. The perks of my job are arguably the biggest form of income. I could try to score us a room through an advertising trade, but I've been slacking on my social media and blogging, and I'm not sure I still have enough clout. Besides, a lot of places won't do that with influencers. Some will even screenshot your email requests and post them online to shame you. It's not like I'm George Clooney. I'm just some girl who takes pretty pictures. I might be able to land us a discount. A free room's unlikely.
We'll figure something out, Alex says. Do you want to shower first, or should I?
I can tell from the way he's holding his arms slightly away from his body that he's desperate to be clean. And if he hops in the shower now, maybe I'll even manage to get the temperature down a few degrees in the meantime. Go ahead, I tell him, and he slips away. The whole time I can hear the water running, I'm pacing. From the fold-out pseudo-bed to the plastic-wrapped balcony to the thermostat. Finally, it drops down to 81, and I reset the goal temperature to 80 and keep pacing. After deciding to document this so I can report it to Airbnb and try to get some money back, I take pictures of the chair bed and the porch. The construction upstairs has mercifully ceased for the day, so at least it's quiet, the hum of conversation and splash of water drifting up from the pool, then head back to the thermostat, down to 80 now, to take a picture of that too. Just as I'm resetting the temperature for 79, the shower turns off. So I swing my suitcase up onto the fold-out chair, unzip the bag, and start rooting through it for something lightweight to wear to dinner. Alex steps out of the bathroom in a cloud of steam, with a towel wrapped around his waist, one hand securing it at the hip as the other swipes through his wet hair, leaving it sticking up and out messily.
Your turn, he says.
But it takes me a second to compute through the haze of his long, lean torso and the sharp jut of his left hip bone. Why is it so different seeing someone in a towel than in a bathing suit? 30 minutes ago, Alex was technically more naked than this, But now, the smooth lines of his body feel more scandalous. I feel like all the blood in my body is just bobbing to the surface, pressing against my skin so that every inch of me is more alert. It never used to be like this. This is all because of Croatia. Damn you and your gorgeous islands, Croatia.
Poppy?
Alex prompts.
Mm-hmm,
I say, then remember to at least add, yeah. I spin back to my bag and grab a dress, bra, and underwear at random. Okay, bedroom's all yours. I hurry into the steamy bathroom and shut the door as I'm stripping off my bikini top, only to freeze, stunned at the sight of a huge, blue-tinted glass capsule that occupies the entirety of one wall, complete with a reclined seat on either side, like it's some kind of group shower from the Jetsons. Oh my God. This, I'm sure, was not in the photographs. In fact, this whole room is unrecognizable from the one on the website, transformed from the subtle, beachy grays of its former self into the glowing blue and sterile whites of the hypermodern site before me. I snatch a towel off the rack, wrapping it around myself, and throw the door open.
Alex, why didn't you say anything about the...
Alex grabs for his towel and pulls it around himself, and I do my absolute best to pick up where my sentence stumbled off and pretend that didn't happen.
Spaceship bathroom!
I figured you knew, Alex says, his voice hoarse. You booked this place.
They must have remodeled since the photos were taken, I say. How did you even figure out how to work that thing?
Honestly, Alex says, the hardest thing was just wresting control from the 2001 A Space Odyssey-style artificial intelligence system. After that, the biggest issue was just that I kept mixing up the controls for the sixth shower head with the ones for the foot massager.
It's enough to break the tension. I dissolve into laughter, and he does too, and it stops mattering so much that we're standing here in our towels.
This place is purgatory, I say.
Everything is just nice enough to make the issues that much more glaring.
Nikolai is a sadist, Alex agrees.
Yes, but he's a sadist with a spaceship bathroom.
I lean back into the bathroom to study the many-headed, multi-seated shower again. I burst into another fit of laughter and lean back out to find Alex standing there grinning. He's pulled a t-shirt on over his damp upper body, but hasn't risked swapping the towel out. I turn back to the bathroom.
Okay, I'll leave you to dance naked around the apartment in privacy now. Use your time wisely.
Is that what you do? Alex calls. Dance around the apartment naked whenever I'm in the other room? You do, don't you?
I spin away as I'm pulling the door shut.
Wouldn't you like to know, porny Alex?
12. 9 summers ago. Despite the fact that Alex spent every spare moment of junior year picking up shifts at the library, and thus I spent every spare moment sitting on the floor behind the reference desk eating Twizzlers and teasing him whenever Sarah Torval bashfully drifted by, there isn't money for a big summer trip this year. His younger brother is starting community college next year, without much financial aid, and Alex, being a saint among mere men, is funneling all his income into Bryce's tuition. When he broke the news to me, Alex said, "I understand if you want to go to Paris without me." My reply was instantaneous.
"Paris can wait. Let's visit the Paris of America instead."
He arched a brow.
"Which is?"
"Duh," I said. "Nashville."
He laughed, delighted. I loved to delight him, lived for it. I got such a rush from making that stoic face crack, and lately, there hadn't been enough of that. Nashville is only a 4-hour drive from Linfield, and miraculously, Alex's station wagon is still kicking. So, Nashville it is. When he picks me up the morning of our trip, I'm still packing, and Dad makes him sit and answer a series of random questions while I finish. Meanwhile, Mom slips into my room with something hidden behind her back, singing,
"Hi, sweetie."
I look up from the Muppet vomit explosion of colorful clothing in my bag.
Hi?
She perches on my bed, hands still hidden.
What are you doing? I say. Are you handcuffed right now? Are we being burglarized? Blink twice if you can't say anything.
She brings the box forward. I immediately yelp and slap it out of her hand onto the floor.
Poppy!
She cries.
Poppy?
I demand.
Not Poppy! Mom! Why are you carrying a bulk box of condoms around behind your back?
She bends and scoops it up. It's unopened, luckily, so nothing spilled out.
I just figured it's time we talked about this.
I shake my head.
It's 9:20 a.m., not the time to talk about this.
She sighs and sets the box atop my overfilled duffel bag.
I just want you kids to be safe. You've got a lot to look forward to. We want all your wildest dreams to come true, honey.
My heart stutters. Not because my mom is implying that Alex and I are having sex. Now that it's occurred to me, of course that's what she thinks, but because I know she's espousing the importance of finishing college, which I still haven't told her I don't plan to do. I've only told Alex that I'm not going back next year. I've been waiting to tell my parents until after the trip, so no big blow-up keeps it from happening. My parents are ultra-supportive, but that's partly because both of them wanted to go to college and neither of them had the support to do so. They've always assumed that any dream I could have would be aided by having a degree. But throughout the school year, most of my dreaming and energy have been devoted to traveling, weekend trips and short stints over breaks from school, usually on my own, but sometimes with Alex, camping, because that's what we can afford, or with my roommate Clarissa, a rich hippie type I met in an informational meeting about study abroad programs at the end of last year. Visits to each of her parents' separate lake houses. She's starting next year, senior year, in Vienna, and getting art history credits for it. But the longer I considered any of those programs, the less interested I found myself. I don't want to go to Australia only to spend all day in a classroom, and I don't want to rack up thousands more in debt just to have an academic experience in Berlin. For me, traveling is about wandering, meeting people you don't expect, doing things you've never done. And aside from that, all those weekend trips have started to pay off. I've only been blogging for 8 months, and already I have a few thousand followers on social media. When I found out I failed my biological science general requirement, and thus it would take me an extra semester to graduate, that was the final straw. And I'm going to tell my parents all this, and somehow I'll find a way to make them understand that school isn't right for me the way it is for people like Alex. But today is not that day. Today we're going to Nashville, and after the last semester, all I want is to let loose. Just not in the way my mother is implying. Mom, I say, I am not having sex with Alex.
You don't have to tell me anything.
She replies with a cool, calm, and collected nod, though that manner goes completely out the window as she goes on.
I just need to know that you're being responsible. Oh my goodness, I can't believe how grown up you are. It's making me teary just thinking about it. But you still have to be responsible. I'm sure you are, though. You're such a smart girl, and you've always known yourself. I'm so proud of you, honey.
I'm being more responsible than she knows. While I've made out with a few different guys over the last year, and did more than that with one, I've still stayed pretty safely in the slow lane. When I tipsily admitted this to Clarissa during a trip to her mom's lake house on the far shore of Lake Michigan, her eyes widened like she was gazing into a scrying pool, and she said, in that airy way of hers,
"What is it you're waiting for?"
I just shrugged. The truth is, I'm not sure. I just figure I'll know it when I see it. Sometimes I think I'm being too practical, which isn't something I've ever been accused of, but with this, I feel at times like I'm waiting for the perfect circumstances for a first time. Other times, I think it might have something to do with porny Poppy. Like, after all that, I'm incapable of losing myself in a moment, in a person. Maybe I just need to make a decision,
choose someone from a lineup of the loosely held crushes I'm harboring on some of the guys Alex and I run into regularly at parties. People in the English department with him, or communications department with me, or any of the other regularly occurring characters in our lives. But for now, I'm holding out hope, waiting for that magical moment when it feels right with one person in particular. That person is not going to be Alex. Actually, if I were to just choose someone, it probably would be. I'd be straight up with him, explain what I wanted to do and why, and probably insist both of us sign something in blood saying it would only happen once and we would never speak of it again. But even if it comes to that, I make a silent and solemn vow right now. I will not be using a condom from the bulk box my mom just tucked into my suitcase. I really, really swear to you I don't need these, I say. She stands and pats the box. Maybe not now, but why not hold on to them, just in case? Also, are you hungry? I've got cookies in the oven and shoot, I forgot to run the dishwasher. She hurries from the room, and I finish packing, then drag my bag downstairs. Mom's at the island, chopping browned bananas for banana bread while the cookies cool, and Alex is sitting in that very rigid way beside my father. Ready? I say, and he springs off the stool like I was born ready to not be sitting next to your very intimidating father.
Yep.
He scrubs his hands down the fronts of his pants legs.
Yeah.
It's right around then that he clocks the box of condoms tucked under my arm. This, I say. This is just 500 condoms my mom gave me in case we start boning. Alex's face flushes.
Poppy!
Mom cries. Dad looks over his shoulder, aghast.
Since when are you two romantically involved?
We don't do that, sir,
Alex tries. Here, will you carry these out to the car, Dad? I toss them over the island to him. My arm's getting tired from holding it. Hopefully our hotel has those big luggage carts. Alex is still not quite looking at Dad.